I mean, the cafe.
Yeah. Well, the demand was drawn up, and it was based on the 62.5 cent minimum. And we had a graduated scale from there on up to 91 cents an hour for tool and die makers. Now I want to go back to what I said a while ago. What were the wages in those days? 15, 17 cents. 17 was about the highest that you could hear any place as far as helpers, laborers, watchmen, sweepers, and these were concerned. In private industry, this was about the maximum. At least I didn't know of any more at that time. And, of course, I said again, the workers were sort of skeptic about how you could do it. But we were able to convince them, of course, that the city does it, and it's a very good thing to fight on. After all, do we want to let the private employers scab on our city scale and so on and so forth? And the result was we won the support of the labor movement, what was in existence, began at that time to pay some attention to these organizations that began to fight. From that up to 91 cents for tool and die makers, and then a graduated scale whereby the machinists, I believe, started in the 70-some cents. But imagine what the wages were before. They were hiring tool and die makers right in the Flower City for 35 cents an hour. Machinists was getting 31 cents an hour. Well, that's quite a jump. And, of course, we expected to... They call collective bargaining a very democratic way of settling things. And of course we were ready to bargain democratically with them and negotiate this and that and certainly even make some compromises, not too many. But anyhow, this was what we presented to them. But never a word from them for a meeting, for negotiations. Not a word. No negotiations. What word? Yes, there was some words come out that they'd never negotiate, and especially in Tetzla. They never negotiate. They ain't going to have no union, and that's all there was to it. Some of them were going to shut down, move out of town, and all that. Of course, in one case there where they said they were going to move out of town, we just got the workers together. They'd been starving in there before. Elected the committee to go up, and that statement was in the paper, and took a statement up and said, well, you want to move out of town? We'll load your damn factory up. For nothing, onto the flat cars and ship you the hell out of town, and we'll make the rest of them who do stay pay a wage. That was the way the workers said then, instead of using it, letting them scare them that they're going to move out of town. Well, that was about the last we heard about anybody moving out of town. And they're all here doing a great business today, including the one that I just told you about. Well, then when they seen they couldn't make it work, of course, like always, they have to begin to figure out now what the hell are we going to do here to bust this thing up. We just can't go on like that. They had some work there that they wanted to do. And so after it had went on for a period of 4 weeks, the strike as a whole lasted 5 weeks. I don't know if right to the day or not, but right in that neighborhood. So one morning at 4 o'clock, when things had been so quiet around there, nobody come. We allowed Mr. Tetzlaff and his office staff to come and get out of his car and go and sit in the office all day if he wanted to. He couldn't do nothing, and let him go back out. And policemen were standing around there fraternizing with them. Of course, there was one thing that I always told them, now, don't get too chummy with these boys. Of course, some of the workers, they still believe there's such a good thing as a policeman with a uniform and a gun on his side. Well, maybe some of them would like to be a good fellow. But in those days of the struggles, we'd had plenty of experience with them. They work under orders. It's the same as being in an army or something. Even though if they wouldn't like to go out and shoot down a worker or a striker, they either go and shoot him when they give them the orders or they haven't got a job. Result of them, most of them thinks more of their job than they do of killing somebody, so they'll kill the guy and then keep their job. And I told them this. I had a lot of experience in West Virginia whereby this friendliness between the... Well, then they had to figure out this way of busting it, as I said. At 4 o'clock one morning, we had only just a skeleton crew of pickets around, just watching developments around the place. 4 o'clock, we knew that the one that was going to make the break is going to be the Flower City, because he showed them the example on how to do it in 1919. Three boxcars. Now, after all, workers there at the gate, they don't interfere with them putting boxcars into a shop yard. So they didn't bother them. And they shoved three boxcars into the yard. I afterwards talked to the engineer who did it on the Milwaukee Railroad down here. My brother used to be engineer there. And I talked with him. He says, boy, if I'd ever known the cargo that was in those boxcars, I'd have never shoved them in. Regardless of job or anything, he wouldn't have done it. He was a good guy. Felt very bad about it. And they opened the boxcar doors, and out of the boxcars jumped all of the, well, you could just look at them. You didn't have to wait until we actually got the evidence, which we got later, who they were and where they were from. You knew they were gangsters. And they had big guns strapped on their sides. They unloaded out of their refrigerators, televisions, food. All three boxcars were just completely loaded with stuff. There was 22 of them that came in, and every one of them had their guns strapped on them when they opened the boxcar doors and jumped down onto the ground. They came, they paraded around the gates, and they talked very tough. Of course, then immediately we got out a leaflet over the city telling what had happened. Of course, a lot of people, maybe they didn't actually come down there to fight, to help the strikers or the union, but they were curious. They wanted to see what these animals looked like. And they came down there, and sure enough, around the gates there, they were parading inside of the gate with their guns on. And of course, I knew that this is the time that they're going to make their big attempt. Well, we also knew that there was an ordinance in Minneapolis whereby a worker cannot stay on an industrial property for longer than 24 hours without absenting himself for at least 8 hours. We had found out that. I mean, I don't know exactly the source, but we were immediately notified this is the ordinance. Well, immediately we went up to the mayor, Merrill Latimer. And, of course, he wanted to think it over, and he would see that this ordinance was enforced. Well, he called me up about 5 o'clock in the evening, our strike headquarters on Franklin Avenue, 27th Street or 26th. Called down there and wanted to see me. Not in his office, and he wouldn't come to strike headquarters. He just wanted to see me. Well, I said, Mr. Latimer, I said, I never talk to anybody by myself. I says, we have committees here. This is a democratic union. You and I couldn't come to any kind of an agreement or understanding. If we did, I want all the workers through their committee to know every word takes place. We want to know what you're going to do and so on and so forth. So he agreed, and he came down and he met me on 27th and Franklin. And of course, his first appeal to us was, we had our committee there that time, right at the minute that he proposed. And the first question he raised was, he sort of begged us, now will you assure me that there will be nothing happens down there between now and the time that their time will be up? I've got to leave them in 24 hours. And when they've been in 24 hours, well, I'll go down and just simply arrest the whole business, including the company, for violating the city ordinance. We said, very good. Mayor, that's just fine. We'll give you all the cooperation we can in you. The only thing we want is them out of there. There's no place in the country for that kind of activity. And he agreed with us on this. So we waited 24 hours. And this was the biggest double cross, which actually meant his downfall as a politician. He tried to come back, but he never could overcome what he'd done at this time. Instead of going down and arresting and taking out the gunman, he sent down police, there must have been at least 75 or 80, to open the lines, and they had organized through the night. I don't know where they got a hold of them, scabs. So when the police broke the line, with their guards inside, that they called them, that the workers could go in. And they were going to be fed inside the plant. Everything was going to be taken care of right inside the plant. Well, there was quite a scuffle took place. Adamer himself herded the workers in. One worker from North Minneapolis, Northeast Minneapolis, who had been a very good farmer laborite and had worked his head off night and day for Latimer, I'll never forget this, he walked up and he turned Latimer around and he says, "Are you the son of a, that I worked my head off day and night? Now you're here breaking our strike." But that was what he actually done. Well, and the onions, this new leadership come on, which had put them on the spot. And they were just as much interested, if not more so, of breaking this new union than even the employers was. That was actually it.
Yeah.
It was, this is Merrill Latimer's words to me with a committee in his office. He was sorry he done it. But he done it under pressure of certain leadership in there. I mean, what did they say to him? Very frankly, this is a left-wing union. You got to bust it. You got to bust that or... Now, these guys had supported them in the campaign. Yeah, they had supported them in the campaign. And this was something new. He didn't realize the strength of this new organization that was coming there, so he was following out, as he told us. He was following out the pressure that was put on him. They had a conference up there. By the way, I want to tell you who was in it, a few of them. The Duns, the Trotskyites. Yeah, they were the ones who was engineering it and went to his office and led the delegation to bust this union, you see. To bust, they said this communist union, that's what they said. And he was going down to bust it. But anyhow, he didn't bust it. He felt damned anxious to get back in his car and get back up to his office too. They didn't get in very many of them. They did get a few in. We don't know where they come from, but there was some strange faces. People who would work there, remember, were out on strike, and they knew every soul. These workers that they brought in there weren't from here and didn't work there before. Well, of course, what did this call for? This called for further action, because the threat was there that they were going to mobilize more force to do it. And that night, immediately there were 50,000 leaflets put out all over town, mainly at all of the streetcar intersections and transfer points. And that night, for the mass meeting to take place, to explain. I mean, it was already in the papers about the gangsters were in there, and it had been in the papers about what had happened that morning, what the mayor had done, and of course the people responded. There was, one paper said there was 20,000 that night. I don't know. I was one of the speakers there. In fact, I was chairman of the speakers. But anyhow, there was a mass of people there. And the policy was for mass picketing around the place with the banners and the demands on the removal of the gangsters. We didn't want to have bloodshed, and we knew these people were there to shed blood, because we had already got the record of a number of them who was brought here under the Berghoff Detective Agency of Cincinnati, Ohio. And we had a liberal writer, his name was Palmer, he used to put out a paper. And he had the day and the date and the record. They were released directly from Columbus, Ohio State Penitentiary and sent here as gunmen on the basis that they would get out if they went and done this job. This was proven. We should have some of those papers around yet. Palmer wrote it up, the names of them, who they were, what they were convicted of. They were convicted of everything among them. But anyhow, that night the mass meeting took place. Perfectly peaceful, but militant. They had a parade about six abreast, going completely around that, and that's a block square down there. Just a mass, plus the thousands of people who were standing on the sidelines. They were singing union songs, Solidarity Forever, and the rest of these. And I was speaking. It happened that the Milwaukee Railroad had been accommodating, unintentionally, of course, but they had a big toolbox sitting right there. There used to be a flagman station. There was gates on this crossing, and this toolbox just made a marvelous platform to speak from. I was speaking from the platform when down the street comes the whole bunch. I don't know how many, but I could see at least five or six from where I was, of these gas cars, armored cars that they had bought, the city had, supposed to be to catch bank robbers. They have had a couple of bank robbers over here. Why, that there, them old gas cars couldn't catch a guy with a wheelbarrow if he could run fast. They were brought here to break strikes, which was actually told afterwards. I understand the city sold them right after that. Ed Hudson, the alderman from the 12th Ward, and Al Bastis from the 6th Ward, and all of the I.G. Scott, who happened to catch one of the gas bombs in his face while he was there. But anyhow, as they came up there, they lined right up between the picket line on the one side and the mass meeting on the other. And I knew that what they were trying to do. At least I felt I knew. And that is, they want to start trouble, and they were at it for. So we thought it was advisable. I talked to a couple of other fellows that were there on the committee, leaders of the union, that we should possibly at this time, because they're not going to run anybody in the plant, let's call the whole picket line over on this opposite side of the street, away from the factory. There's a big field there at that time. It was open. And okay, it was agreed. All right, you go and do it. And we called on another fellow to speak while I was doing this. I climbed down off of the toolbox. I went over. And, of course, I had to go right past the cars. I no more than got right broadside with it, and kablooey goes the tear gas. And from then on, boy, they really come out of there, just like out of the side of a battleship, I guess. Every one of them was opening up. Well, of course, it wasn't long until the whole thing was just blew down there with tear gas. And, of course, the people then, they moved back. Not only, they didn't run away, but after all, being there caught in that tear gas with nothing whatever to fight back with, they had to get with some place where they could fight back. And the cops kept following them and continuing with the tear gas until the workers got over there where somebody had dug a basement and had the block already all piled up there. And somebody thought of, well, now this will make pretty damn good ammunition. We got to protect ourselves. And they bust those concrete blocks up into pieces that they could handle. And I'll tell you, those cops, they retreated then, and they got the hell out of there. Well, and when they left, we resumed our mass meeting, only to the extent of making the announcement that this is not the end of them. They were unsuccessful tonight in doing it, but they'll attempt every other way to also break this strike. And we called on all the people to be back the next night. And the next day they didn't attempt. Everything was quiet around there. The next night the same thing happened. The march was formed on Franklin 26th at the strike headquarters. They marched down to the Flower City. They began to marching around the place. And mass meeting was being held just the same as the night before. And finally, I believe probably every squad car that they had, plus the tear gas cars, everything came down that night. And while the march was going on, they come and busted into the picket line and told them to get out of there. Of course, then we had planned before that if they do it, as long as there's no scabs there, all right, move away from them, move across the street. Them cops can't go in and run this factory. Let them have a heyday out of it. But the thing that happened was they come down there with their sawed-off shotguns, their pistols. They were all ready when they jump out of the car. They went right into the mass of people, into the picket line, shoved and hollered and kicked and everything. And one fellow there, I would like to think of his name right now, who was not a striker, but an old member of the machinist union who had carried his card all the way through all these years. He was there. But he was crippled. Big, heavy-set fellow. And he couldn't walk very fast. It was one leg. It was very bum. And one policeman come along. Well, all you had to do was get near the policeman, and you could just smell like a brewery or a distillery or something like that. It was found out afterwards that they were all drunk. I mean, they were giving drinks all over wherever it was. But anyhow, Herman, that was the name of this fellow, the most of the crowd had moved. We had given orders. All right, if they come, move across the street, but we're going to hold the mass meeting. That we have the right to do. But in order that they couldn't accuse of anybody provoking anything, well, they just hopped out and they started in there as clubbing and beating, and this old fellow that couldn't walk very fast says, come on, get across there, get over there. Well, he says, in his broken German that he had at that time, he says, I'm moving as fast as I can. Can't you see I'm crippled? We'll move you a little faster, and point blank, shot the man right through the hip, just like that. Well, by that time, of course, we figured tonight we're going to be a little more prepared than we was before. And if they attacked us, we're going to give them something. Because if they want to make a war out of this, double cross, protect these guys in there against the law, and so on and so forth, the workers will have to enforce the law. That's constitutionally, I mean, if anybody breaks the law, well, as a citizen, you're supposed to enforce it. Well, it had been broken on every hand. So they just kept up the shooting, chasing the crowd back. But it so happened that there had been some organization going on, too. We had some dump trucks, and those dump trucks were loaded with very nice size, hand-sized rocks and pieces of bricks. As the fighting went on and the shooting was taking place, the trucks on a couple of the streets up there, they just went and they raised the bodies of the trucks like that, and they just strew the streets with rocks. And let me tell you, when the workers got a hold of those rocks, them cops, they beat it for hiding. Well, now, out of this, that fight started at 9 o'clock in the morning. It continued all night until daylight. The workers were playing for positions and the police were playing for positions. Every place that they could see even the head of somebody, the cops shot. Well, how many? There was 36 people shot that night, 2 killed. It was just, in one way, I mean, neither one of the ones who were killed were even in the demonstrations. But they were people that they could catch easy. Because the other workers, they knew a little bit on how to handle herself, and they did protect herself. But along with it, there were 17 policemen put in the hospital, too, in that night. And, when morning came, the committee was always in contact with each other. I mean, the chairman of the strike committee and the chairman of the picket captain, we've always had our ways of communicating with each other. And of course, the word went out, well, once it gets daylight, let's disperse. Disperse, and we'll go to certain places. Some of them didn't want to because they was afraid that they would run some scabs in or something like that, but I didn't think, and the committee didn't think, that they were in a position to run any scabs in that morning. In fact, they were probably more anxious to get out of there than the workers were. Some of them, you had quite a time inducing them to leave the ground. But nevertheless, they did. Well, I'll never forget, just a sort of an offhand prediction that I made after the committee got in the car. We didn't go to headquarters because we wasn't too sure about what would happen, but we went to another place, a fellow's home, and we were discussing about further strategy of the strike. Well, that's a very good thing. But I'm going to just make a little prediction. That strike's over. Of course, the question comes up, why do you think that strike's over? I says they're afraid to carry it on one more night. That was a prediction I made. After all, before that fight was over that night, the papers claimed, this was the second night, you know, that we're talking about now, the papers itself, and I think it's a matter of record yet, said there was over 20,000 people involved in it, of the city of Minneapolis, you know. And I says, how many people are there tonight? There'll be 150,000 people there. Or any time they move. The people were up in arms all over about this. Not against the union, but against the one they should be. The companies, Mayor Latimer and his police force. And I'll tell you, there wasn't a person in Minneapolis, including many of the ministers, that didn't speak out against. The newspapers then, while they wouldn't even issue a statement of the union prior to this time, only one prior to this time, but then afterwards, they were against it. I mean, they were against what Mayor Latimer done. Certainly politics, they thought maybe he was a farmer laborite, I suppose, you know. But anyhow, my prediction came true. 9 o'clock, a little after 9, a taxi cab drove up to my house. Taxi cab driver just had instructions, verbal instructions, requesting me to come up to the Citizens Alliance. McAloon, who is still up there, he could verify every word of it, requested by McAloon. Of course, I could only tell the taxi driver that, well, now, I don't go and see Mr. McAloon myself. He's the employer's man. But we would go up. I had a sort of a hunch I knew what we wanted to see us for. But we will get the committee. We already had our committee set up to negotiate if they wanted to. So we got the negotiating committee, not the strike committee. And we went up to McAloon's office. Very warm greeting. Didn't see an employer sitting around any place. Had a little chat about the strike. And he pulls out a paper. Not a paper that the company had made, but the original demands and contract that we had sent to the company was signed by 14 employers who had been in there that morning prior to 9 o'clock. We never met with one employer. Now, is this important? I think it's historical. And the best mathematician, or whatever you would want to call them, or accountant, and there have been some pretty good ones figure on it, that strike increase, the increase in wages alone, besides putting all the workers back to work, paid for all the time they were off. There were some workers who did compromise. After all, you just can't get everything 100%, but nevertheless, some of them, it was off 2 years, they took 1 year's pay, you see. Some of them got $1,000, some of them got, a couple guys got over $2,000, you know, who were fired way back under the old AFL and the machinists, and the new union, and the new blood that came in, put them back, because after all this now, you see, one of the important things of going back in, now we are a part of the union from which these fellows were fired. So besides protecting those that we took into the new union, we also went back and gave protection to people who had been fired 2 years before that. It was a bunch of surprise people, never thought it could be done. But the increase figured out 117%, one, on the picket line and not in any office negotiating. 14 employers. Well, now this year has been a long story. But what did this mean? This meant the building of the unions in Minneapolis. Building of the unions in Minneapolis on a new basis. There's a sideline to this. During the strike and during the lull, a very good union man who couldn't do very much by himself, regardless even of all of his convincing ways, and he was a good union man, and he was a good strategist. In the Lathrop's Union, well, they had a good fighting group there, but they couldn't do nothing. They were just a bunch of good fighters. And out, while they were unemployed, the good Lathrops, out on the jobs where they were building, as the Lathrops used to call them, shacks, there was Lathers working out there who was also Union Lathers, support as far as membership is concerned, but working with either kickbacks to the employer. It was all explained to us there, because he had been on our picket line, had been in our strike committee. And came in with a question one day, explained what the situation was. All the union men are out of work. The only ones is the ones who are practically scabs. They're out here doing what little laughing there is, and so on and so forth. I said to him, I said, why don't you do something about it? A man probably who would have as much experience, maybe not exactly the same kind of experience that I had. Well, the thing is, what the hell can we do about it? That was the question. How can we close down these scab jobs that's supposed to be union jobs, supposed to be employing union carpenters, union lathers, union everything, and they're not even paying union scale, and they're smashing the union by not giving the good union people anything to work. Well, I said, the only way you can do it is shut them down. Well, how can this be done? Well, I says, in my opinion here, we got a bunch of workers that's actually itching to help you do that. I says, if I was you, I'm not in your union or not attempting to tell you what to do. But I know what I would do in this situation. I would go to every job, and I knew where the jobs was going on. I would either make that employer, well, there's a number of things I would make him do. One, I'd make him pay the union scale. Secondly, there would be no kickback, because they did have a good scale, so it was just enforced. Thirdly, you will employ according to seniority rights through the union. That's the only place we got seniority. And they got seniority there. See? By golly, they grabbed onto it like this. When will we go? I says, what's the matter with tomorrow morning? I says, a lot of guys, just all you have to do is just put out a call for fellas to go out and help the lathers to straighten out the situation. My God, and the next morning they come down with cars and trucks and everything that had moved. And the leadership of the lathers, it so happened I couldn't go along. But they just went completely over the town from one place to the other. And they straightened things out. In one day, they just had it straightened out like that. And they got their union wages, they got their demands, the people who had been discriminated against got their turn at their work, and so on and so forth. Well, that made a very, very close relationship between the Lathers and the other unions. And I said that was a sideline, a thing that happened during a lull in this strike down here. Well, now there was one thing that I said, that this ruined Merrill Latimer politically. He thought he had to do as these people says, or he's done. That was politics with him. He admitted that he done. But instead of that, what did he find in the next election? He found the same people who were leading and the same unions who were fighting in the interest of the workers was also leading in the political situation. And Merrill Latimer couldn't even get the nomination. Sure, the election was lost. But it wasn't lost to any worse than what he had done there. Whether he wanted to do it or not, I think it nearly broke his heart after he found out. It was just too bad because, after all, the man had done some wonderful things in the past. But when you are going to allow yourself to be influenced by reactionaries and so on and so forth, regardless of how good you may have been, you can't be good any longer. There's two that I cited. One was Herman Hussman and the other was Merrill Latimer. Herman Hussman was fired. In fact, I was offered his job as the international representative. And I think I should mention why I didn't take it. I was taken right over here on Franklin Avenue to this hotel on Franklin and 3rd Avenue, Windsor. Yes, by the first vice president of the International Association of Machinists. I should and will in a minute tell what happened. But anyhow, after we had won this strike, why, I say, these people, you never got so many pats on your back in your life. Man, oh man, if we had leadership like this all over the country, how we could build our union. I said, you can build it, but you got to do exactly the same as we do. You got to protect workers. And, of course, the machinists did do a lot better after that. This had an effect nationally. But Harvey Nickerson came here to me, called me up home, and wanted to meet me at the district headquarters. Well, I'm just a little local organizer. I just stay in there. I'm still organizer. And he wanted to see me, and I met him over to the district headquarters over on University in Raymond. Well, after he got done congratulating and all of that, and he had a big smile on, forced, of course, he wanted me to go over to Windsor Hotel with him. Well, first we went out, filled my car with gas, bought the swell dinner, and then we went over there. When we went over there, that used to be the nest of the reactionaries from the top in the AFL, including Meyer Lewis was there. Yes, he even introduced me to Meyer Lewis. Says, you don't have to introduce me. I know Mason, sure. They were sitting in there, and they had all kinds of drinks, all kinds of eats, and they really keep an apartment over there, or did in those days. They lived like kings when they come to town. And they, of course, told me all about the wonderful work that I had done, but as I've always felt, I can't do anything by myself. I can only help to give leadership to workers. The workers do it. It isn't the leader that does it. He may have good ideas that's accepted by the workers, and this brings victory to them. But as I told him, and I've always told other people in other situations, it's the workers. They have to know. They have to have confidence. And the workers will fight for their rights. This is proven not only then, but many other times. Well, in this meeting that we had over there, after a whole day, he finally got to the crux of why he was here. And he told me, he says, you know, he says, this damn Hussman, he says, he's no good. He used to be all right. I mean, now he's referring back to the time before they ruined him. He used to be all right, but now he's just a damn drunk. That's what he told me. We want you to take the job. We know what your economic conditions were. In fact, I didn't get paid for organizing. I got maybe a little expense enough to buy coffee or something like that. That's all. They couldn't pay salaries yet. You know, they had big expense. Strikes, they had bills from that and all that. But anyhow, got a little. And, of course, he knew all this. And he just recited it just about the way it was. Now, why in the hell should we let you do sacrifice all like that? We're going to put you up where you belong. Well, I said, Mr. Hussman, I said, I certainly don't want to take our brother Hussman. I don't want to take Herman's job. But there's a thing I agree with. He hasn't done a thing. He has no workers, have no confidence in him. All the things you've stated is true. But I don't know if I would want to take his job. Maybe we can make Herman do something. No, that's out. They were ready to let him go. I mean, they wasn't going to pay him anymore. But I understand afterwards they did. But after I hadn't said yes or no to what he had proposed to me, I knew now, just let you ramble on. You're going to come to the main point about this. And, of course, I didn't say yes or no. And when he'd say, well, now you know how to better your situation, and they even put you in a position to where you can do better work. And, well, possibly, and this was the answers that I gave him. But he got, finally, I don't know if he knew I was a little bit suspicious of what he was going to say or not, because he did look kind of funny. He says, you know, though, now, Brother Mayville, he says, if you go to work for the International, and we put you on as the international representative here. Of course, he told me that it means $5,000 a year, plus all expenses. And of course, he kind of gave it away. He said, you know how to put the expenses in. I don't have to tell you. In other words, just help yourself. It's there. And, but he says, of course, he says, you know, you will have to work under the jurisdiction of the international. He says, the international will lay down your policies for you. Well, I says, Brother Nickerson, it took a hell of a long time for you to get around there, didn't it? I says, I knew it was coming this morning. But I says, I want to tell you, first of all, in very short words, I don't have to spend a lot of breath on you. You take your job of international representative, your $5,000 a year, your expense money, and shove them so damn far that nobody will ever find them, understand? My principles are not for sale. Oh, on top of that, by the way, I want to put in here, I was a known member of the Communist Party at that time. And along with this going along, I had to sign an open statement that I resigned. Oh. And that's what I told him. And I said, whether I am or not, that's none of your damn business. And I make a public statement on nothing. Now I says, you can go back to Washington and you tell Brother Wharton, just exactly, he's the international president, what I said. Well, now this was the offer. After strike, well, here's what happened shortly after this. Probably I shouldn't use so much time on this, but I'll make it short. After I was such a good fella, 3 weeks after that comes a letter from the international, after they'd offered me the job, that I am expelled from the Communist Party because I'm a member, or I'm expelled from the International Association of Machinists because I'm a member of the Communist Party.
Oh.
Yep, that was it. Well, that required a long fight. We went through the various channels. You have to go through your own local first. They refused to even accept any sponsor. Carried it through the district over here, in the same place over on University Avenue in Raymond. There the district refused to, while they had mobilized all of the reactionaries that they could possibly get to come over there, but nevertheless the district as a whole, including some of them who weren't very progressive, voted against them to allow me, or allow them to expel me. Of course it goes through these channels, from there you go to the conventions, you first go to the Grand Lodge, and if there you can't get action, you know, then you can take it to the first convention that comes up. Well, the Grand Lodge had already acted, so there's only one thing to do is wait for the convention. We went to the convention. It was held in the Feaster Hotel in Milwaukee. And for 3 days, that convention was tied up on two issues. One, on the suspension of a fellow by the name of Mike Dillon's union from Oakland, California, who refused to be sold out by the International, and on my expulsion. And every day they would promise that, well, we're going to have it up before the committee and then we'll bring it before the convention. But 3 days, that convention was tied up. It has the longest minutes ever in the history of the International Association of Machinists National Convention. It's really a book. I mean, the people were fighting on the floor. We couldn't get before the hearing committee. And the result was the rank and file delegates was taking it up on the floor, demanding it to be brought directly on the floor, demanding that I be allowed to speak on the floor. And that's the way it went on for 3 days. But we finally decided, well, we'll go on back. They didn't take action. Then you resort to the courts. I resorted to the courts, brought it back here into court in Minneapolis, was reinstated back in as business agent of the International Association of Machinists, Local 1313, with the stipulation paid for all time lost, which didn't amount to very much. I mean, that was sort of a hollow victory on that one score. But along with it, there was something else very important. A contempt of court order placed in there that prevented anybody, either officer or member, from interfering with my membership in the International Association of Machinists on the same grounds. Well, now this was a long, long struggle. I'm just going to quickly go over just a couple of other instances. I mean, I'm only speaking mainly about what I was involved in. But you could go on. I mean, the truck drivers was a big struggle. And I think here's one thing that probably isn't recorded. Especially about the second truck driver strike, that was where the real fight took place. I mean, that's where the killings took place. And a lot of people look, I mean, at the real part because it was killings. That isn't the main reason why. It was important because there was political figures involved in this. The workers had the truck industry really tied up. There was nothing moving here. They had it very successful, and of course always the employers looks for the most possible place to bust that strike, to make the first break in it. And they selected the place, I think it was up on 3rd Street North. I know where the building is. I'm not too sure if it was 3rd or 4th. What they thought was a very favorable place. So they send a big truck in there to load up. Well, all the workers done was just got in front of the truck and they stood there. They just refused to move. That's all there was to it. And The result was the truck was blocked. And the National Guards had already been called in here. They were stationed here in Minneapolis. They were stationed in a building there on right by the courthouse on 5th Street and 5th Avenue. And there had been conferences held with Governor Olson there. I happened to be in one of the committees because in those days they had United Front strike committees. It wasn't a matter of just one union, but you invited all unions to send representation over into your strike committee. But in this case, the National Guards had been called in, as they said, to protect the workers. Whether it was a mistake or not, I mean, they didn't understand why Governor Olson ordered the National Guards down at that time. That I don't know. I can't read what his mind was. But here's what happened. While the workers were standing in front of the truck, and another truckload of strikers, of workers, in a dump truck, drove up in back of the truck and was only standing there. And here comes the police from Minneapolis. They, in squad cars, jumped out. Never asked a question, never demanded that they move the workers, never demanded one thing. Jumped out and point blank with their guns shot. I don't remember how many was wounded into that truckload of workers. Killed two of them. Just there like that. Well, then the workers, they were looking for ways and means of fighting back too. But instead of that, here comes in the National Guard. And they didn't arrest the police, but they arrested workers by the hundreds. They set up a compound over on the state fairgrounds over there. They just took the workers over there by the hundreds. Now this was Governor Olson's orders. I mean, he was the head of the National Guard. Well, of course that didn't break the strike. Like in all cases of that kind, it makes the workers more determined. But they were weakened. There was the best leaders of their picket lines was held in compounds over there for days and days, you know, under practically a military prison. Well, I'm going to only cite one more thing if you have time, and that is what happened and how I come to leave here. Well, after the reinstatement, which I always think was a mistake in one way, but I did some good where I went, I shouldn't have left Minneapolis. But right following that, I mean, one thing led to the other. When the workers in one place seen that the workers in another place had fought and brought about victory, that gave them inspiration that they could do the same thing. And it was only a matter of just weeks. And the timber workers all over the state, they went on strike. A committee come down from Duluth, including the president of the Minnesota or the district union here, I believe it was. They had an organization, had good organization in Michigan and in Minnesota. But they came down here and the strike broke out in Minnesota. They had started organization in Wisconsin. They came down to Minneapolis because all of the forces of the timber workers were involved in the Minnesota strike. They had to call out their people from Wisconsin who had started organization to come here and assist. And of course they had came down, selected me. They wanted me to come up. Well, I was called in and we talked it over. I wasn't anxious to go, but when they put it in the light that they did, well, Jesus, we've got organization that just, if we win here in Minnesota, what we've built over there will just simply be gone. And of course, from them, I knew some of them, pressure got pretty big, and then practically all of the leading people here, they, in the labor movement, they thought maybe I'm speaking now of the progressive part of it. They probably thought I should go over. So, okay, I went to the union meeting and I resigned. there's opposition to it, but after all, when I explain to them, after all, there's hundreds of guys in this union now can take my place. And there is. I mean, they learn, and they become good union functionaries, if you want to put it that way. And anyhow, they released me. But there's another thing that probably never happened any place else in the country, and I may be the only one that was ever voted that. They released me only on the basis that I would accept a lifetime membership in Local 1313 of the International Association of Machinists. Well, I couldn't turn down, after all, but it's a matter, it's on the minutes and it's on the record. Lifetime membership with no dues and with the right of coming in and talking, or speaking and appearing before the meeting and in the meetings anytime. The only thing I couldn't vote, you see. That there was quite an honor that I had. I went to Wisconsin. Well, first I had to go by the way of Duluth. That's where the district headquarters was. And I run into the first real militancy of workers just when I got the other side of Sandstone. The employers up there had hired some scabs to drive these trucks, and they just went out to get a load of logs someplace to drive through the picket lines. And boy, I'll tell you, from Sandstone on up, I didn't see the rest of the northern part of the country up there. But I'll tell you, there was trucks, loads of logs. Those logs didn't go to the mill. They went in the ditch. And there was just one after the other. And in each of these cases, while I didn't personally see it, but it was all told, in each of these cases, they had a driver and a guard, or whoever it was, and in each case where they captured them, I know they had quite a compound, the workers of their own, and quite a statue of arms in Carrollton up there. They just got a lot where they brought these guys in, and every one of them had a rifle, these scabs, you know, or the guy that was protecting the driver. They held them there for several days, but anyhow, they didn't get through their log. Well, getting back over in Wisconsin, because here was a real situation of where workers fought again. Well, I was put in charge as an international representative in the district. Well, the first place I went into over there, practically the first place, was considered the toughest place. The Connor Lumber and Land Company, who had been, as we dubbed them, King Connor. The fellow who ruled the northeast section of Wisconsin over there, who hadn't paid and crowed about it, one nickel in cash, I think for 12 years or something like that, or maybe the time was shorter, but anyhow, starting organization, it was quite a difficult thing, and then we had to go back to the same thing before, find out who are the good fellows, visit them, have one fellow get a couple more for the next night, and then branch out and have another fellow. They wouldn't all know the same ones, and then we wasn't anxious to get them in large groups. Somebody else, get two or three more over to his house, over to one of the other fellow's houses, and in that way, we'd go and visit them, you see, and we'd get them in the organization, get them solid. So we finally reached the point that, well, Connor, then he started his fire. So I, with the committee, we went over a couple of miles out of town, Silver Lake, I believe it was. We got the pavilion. There was one nice thing about it, though. The whole countryside, regardless of who it was, they were against them. Connor ruled them, even if they were a business of their own. They either done as he said, or he could ruin them. All he could do, he'd just ruin them by telling his guys, because they had to accept scrip up in the Silver Lake Pavilion. And of course, you've got to be prepared for these things, because we had had experience, not that I was in before, but just prior to that, the same company had a strike up in Michigan, the Michigan Timber Workers' Strike, in which the attorney, Henry Paul, and the president of the Michigan Union up there were both kidnapped, taken across the state line, beat up with rocks, be sure that they would bring a number of people to this meeting to protect him. Workers started to come. We were all very surprised. I mean, from the mill, but I guess they must have said, well, by God, if this union is is one that's going to stick it out. They're going to fight it out with Connor. After all he's done, they're still going to have public meetings. And I'll tell you, there was a big crew of people come over. There must have been 150 of the mill workers that come over. And, we just went to start the meeting. Of course, these lumberjacks, they are put in a proper place right by the door, I mean, to see that nobody comes in and crashes it and not use the vigilante stuff that they did before. In other words, the defense committee. But it so happened that just after most of the workers had got there, who walks in? Connor himself, Bill Connor, along with a group of these vigilantes. He had about 6 or 8 guys with him. I think that was about all there was. And when we opened the meeting, we had a chairman, a guy who got up, one of his own workers, and acted as chairman. He was pretty scared, but nevertheless he did. And he introduced me, the organizer, who was going to speak. And just as I got up to speak, Connor and his vigilantes started across the floor. The bandstand was in the middle of this pavilion where the music would play during dances and affairs. Mm-hmm. There's going to be no meeting here tonight, he began to holler. No meeting here tonight. Well, I just started to talk. And of course, the lumberjacks, they got around behind him and started to also march over towards the platform. And when he started to cross there, I said, oh yes, Mr. Connor, there's going to be a meeting here tonight. No meeting here tonight. Well, at that time, I was pretty warm, so I just took my coat off, threw it back on the chair. I said, well, brothers, we have another little problem to solve first. And that's between Mr. Connor and I as to whether or not we're going to have a meeting here tonight. We're going to fight it out right here on this platform. I says, now come on, Mr. Connor. You says, I'm not going to speak, and I say, I am. I says, come on up. He stopped dead in his tracks. And I says, now if you don't think we're going to have a meeting, Mr. Connor, if you'll just take a look around there, right in back of you. I says, there's the guy that's going to ensure that we're going to have a meeting tonight. Now I says, you're perfectly willing to stay, are perfectly welcome to stay. You can sit down, you can stand up, as long as you don't become disorderly. And I says, you're welcome to stay in the meeting. And believe it or not, he stayed all the way through the meeting. And at the end of the meeting, I says, now, brothers, I says, here's your boss, Mr. Connor. He's seen every one of you here, every one of you. We protect only union members, see? He know that you didn't come just out of curiosity. You came to join a union tonight. If you want to go back in that mill tomorrow morning with assurance that you will not lose your job, the only salvation for you is to come up here and sign up with the union. And every worker in the hall signed up that night. Maybe he signed up because he was afraid. But it so happened he didn't fire them all the next day. He fired a few. Fired those, the guy who was chairman, and so on and so forth. Well, that day we got our committee together and we presented demands again similar to what we did in the Flower City, which included a decent wage scale for those days, if it's possible to have such a thing. Reinstatement for all of the guys who had been discharged, our general contract covering all the important things for a union in those days, and besides that, going back as much as 2 years, you know, been a number of times that somebody tried to start an organization there, and he busted them all. But this time, he didn't bust us, but instead, he used every maneuver that could possibly be thought of. We drawed up a demand, committee did, presented to the union, and we had good attendance at these unions, even though they were taking a chance. He'd slowed down on